States of America, and it's time now for QSO Live. And we want to say a very pleasant good evening to everyone, and hello to David over here, who is the official co-host of the show.
Official? That's my official title now?
As long as he behaves himself, that's okay. The problem.
Well, you know, hopefully I will see a pay raise now that I have the official title.
There you go. Now, we have, of course, I didn't agree to that. I just said, there you go. anyhow, we have someone with us tonight, a very special guest. I want to say this fellow has to be what I would consider to be the official ambassador of amateur radio, period. I can't think of anybody that's been front and center for ham radio in our time. I mean, we can go back and look at some folks in the past, you know, but right now, today, over the last decade, this is the guy. And I'd like to introduce K9EID, known other than Bob Heil.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you very much for that nice introduction. Oh, I don't think I can handle all of that.
Well, it's true. It's true. I mean, it's like you have made a full-time job out of promoting our fraternity. You know, I mean, it's every time you turn around, you turn it into ham radio. I don't care what you're doing, that somehow you relate it to this fraternity. And that, I think that is so cool, because you're bringing people in, introducing people to this fraternity that would otherwise probably not give it much thought. And
the whole thing evolves around the fact that I have two great careers, all because of what I learned on ham radio as a 15-year-old kid. And I'm still learning every day. I really mean that. I mean, I love helping people, and yet when I help them, I learn things too. I learned something today. A young man, my job here, we'll get into that a little bit, but my particular job is answering lots. Kick the old can around there. Answering sometimes hundreds of emails a day from all of the people from both our company as well as our Ham Nation and our own personal delights. I love talking to people and helping them. And a young man asked me today how to hook up a microphone to a specific transmitter, and he has some kind of a special little box he found that really looks cool. So we'll get into that and see what happens. And so I learn things every day. But the main thing is that I am just so involved in helping people, and that's where it's at with me. I learned it myself from 15 years old, getting on 6 meters back in 1956. The bands were open constantly. It was an amazing time to get into ham radio, and I had a Harvey Wells. My parents bought me a Harvey Wells at Walter Ashe and an SX-99 and an RME-152. That was a huge box, bigger than just about any receiver today, that was a converter for 6 meters, 2 meters, and 220 megacycles, and that put the old Harvey Wells and the SX-99 ready to go. So we worked a lot of stuff for that first 10 years. But the first night or two that I was on, I met this guy, and I met him in a strange way. AM was it. I mean, it was it, especially on 6 meters. There was nobody on single sideband. It was all AM. But I tuned around one night, and I heard this gosh-awful signal, really garbled. I thought, what is this? Next night, I come back about the same time and same frequency, and there it was again. And I thought, oh, wait a minute. That could have been some of this single sideband stuff. So I put on the old BFO, and guess what? There he was, K0DGE. And he was one of the first 10 single sideband stations in the country on 6 meters. And we met up every night. He'd do adjustments on his transmitter he was building, because very few people talked to him. Well, I thought it was really cool. And at that same time, I was playing the organ at the Fox Theater in St. Louis, and I would go in and play the shows at night, and we'd have sometimes 3 hours in between the shows. He said, "You ought to come and visit me," and he gave me his address, and I rolled up in front of this address. Well, my mom did, because I wasn't old enough to drive at the age of 15, and it was KMOX CBS Radio, and I go in and ask for Larry, and there he was. He was the chief engineer of CBS and KMOX. And from there, I became his great student. What a wonderful teacher. And he taught me. I said, "Would you build me one of those rigs?" "Nope." He says, "I won't do it, but I'll teach you how." And he did. And I went on right behind him to be one of the first few single sideband stations on 6 meters, thanks to Larry.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO Live, and our special guest, Bob Heil. We'll be right back with more right after this. Here's a great idea from hamtestonline.com. If you've already got your ticket and you know someone you'd like to get into the fraternity of ham radio, this is the time to do it with a special program called Ham It Forward. You could pick up a membership. They're about $25 for the technician test. And I'm telling you, I know folks that couldn't put batteries in a flashlight that wound up getting their ticket through Ham Test Online. Ham It Forward. That's the name of the program. Get other folks involved in this fraternity of ham radio. You will be so glad you did. It takes all the work out of being an Elmer and gives you the confidence, as well as the person taking the test, that they know the material and it's easy, it's not boring. HamTestOnline.com for Ham It Forward. HamTestOnline.com. If you're looking to purchase a new piece of ham gear, think no further than R&L Electronics. That's R&L Electronics. You can find them in Google. You can locate their website. And you need to go there. These are folks you can trust. These are folks that you will enjoy purchasing a piece of equipment from. And not only are they honest, but they will give you the best possible price. Prices that you won't find at any other ham radio distributor. That's why I go there. And I love the friendly folks. Let me tell you, if you're thinking about antennas, transmission line, microphones, amplifiers, antenna tuners, HTs, whatever you've got on your mind, do not hesitate. Do not hold back. Call R&L Electronics. Google them on the web. You can find them real easy. That's R&L Electronics. If you enjoy listening to shortwave at home, you'll enjoy it even more in the car. You can get away from the dull, boring AM, FM stations and listen to something really cool on shortwave in your car with Car Shortwave Radio. Their website is carshortwaveradio.com. A small, inconspicuous antenna mounts either on your trunk or on your hood, plugs into the cigarette lighter, comes in on your car radio, and you can read the frequency out on your car radio dial. You control it all with a little key fob. It's slick. It makes your car radio sound like a Wurlitzer jukebox when you're listening to WTWW. Go to carshortwaveradio.com. That's carshortwaveradio.com. Once again, go to carshortwaveradio.com, and you'll be glad that you did. I want to tell you about something that's just absolutely, simply amazing. And you say, what's that? Well, it's the MFJ 939 Automatic Antenna Tuner. And you ask, what's so amazing about it? Well, it's very small, compact unit. It'll handle up to 200 watts. I mean, it'll handle a Drake TR-4, a Swan 350, or any modern radio that's out there. You simply plug the output into the 939 antenna tuner, give it about 5 to 10 watts, and it just tunes. No cable. You don't have to have a cable running between the tuner and the radio. It's utterly fantastic. Very quiet. You will love this thing, and it's priced unbelievably low. You need to go to the website, MFJEnterprises.com, and check out the 939 antenna tuner, or just Google MFJ 939. Okay, right now, I'm sitting next to a stack of QSL cards and a stack of U.S. postage stamps. That's right. You want one of these QSL cards? Do ya? Well, then get off your butt and send us an email. The email address is simple. It's simply email at WTWW.us. That's email at WTWW.us. And we will send you a QSL card. You'll have your own WTWW official QSL card. Hey, once again, folks, thanks so much for listening to WTWW, your favorite shortwave radio station just outside Nashville, Tennessee. You're listening to QSO Live. And now back to our special guest, Bob Heil.
Then I got hot onto 2 meters and I built a band switching transverter. And you had to build your stuff. You didn't just go buy a radio and it had 6 meter sideband on it. Most of them didn't even have 6 meters on them. So that's my humble beginning, Ted, is I just became enthralled with burning the soldering iron and building things. And then when you turn it on, you get it works and you talk to people. How much fun is that, my friend? And I bet you did a lot of that too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. And I guess I was going to say, I think I still have an RME receiver here, and it's a big, it's got this big dial. It's right. It's a round dial. It's real impressive. And I don't know where it's at. Yeah. I'm sure you do this. You go to a ham fest, you see something. Oh, I've got to have that. I've always wanted one of those, you know. And you bring it home and you find that you already have one. Do you ever do that, Bob? I'm just curious, you know.
I was at a ham fest this weekend in Mount Vernon, Missouri. And, man, what a great little ham fest. It's growing every year. And I am so happy to see a ham fest that grows, and this one is doing that. Many of them go the other way. And of course, I came away with about 3 or 4 meters and some wire. And what am I doing? I'm collecting parts for the pine board project, and we'll talk about that later. But I go there and find things, and I didn't see any receivers or stuff that I needed or wanted. I just was looking for parts, and boy, I was happy to come home with some pieces and parts. You got to do that, and so that's what I do at Hamfest.
Well, our parts are getting harder to get. In other words, it used to be we could hang around an old TV repair shop, and chassis of those old televisions, we could get a whole lot of stuff. But today, there's no TV shops around to rob the old chassis. You know, I remember that. I would cannibalize. I would take them home. My mom would get so upset with me because I'd have practically the whole backyard full of TV chassis.
Well, I had that same experience. I was a paper boy in Marissa, Illinois, at the age of about 10 and 11, 12. Even before I got into ham radio, I was into electric trains big time. But then as I got into more of thinking along the lines of ham radio, I'd see these TV sets out on people's curbs. And so I'd go, if they weren't a customer, a newspaper customer, right, I'd go knock on the door and ask them if I could have that. Well, certainly. And I'd drag those suckers home. My dad would go with me later with his pickup truck, and we'd pick them up. And that's where we got our power transformers, our rectifiers, tubes, you know, the whole bit. And today it's not possible. However, I am here to tell the world there are many, many parts places. I get this a lot. When I started this project of building the pine board project, people told me, would come to me, write me emails, "Well, you're crazy, Heil. You can't get parts." No way. I got news for you. Antique electronic supply. They've got every little old part you'd ever want. There's a whole bunch of them. DigiKey, Mauser, Gateway Electronics in St. Louis, and then Tubes. Oh, my. tubes are amazing. And a lot of people say, well, you can't get tubes. I can get you every tube you want, because what I'm going to do with you is turn you over to my buddy Michael, WB0SND, that I talk to just about every morning on our 75-meter AM net at 9 o'clock. Michael has a company called Tubes and More, and he's got tons. He goes to Dayton. He goes to all the fests, and you just put vacuumtubes.com in your old search box, and you'll have every tube you want, and they're not very expensive. I love all this old stuff, but capacitors, tube sockets, transformers. Like, what do you do for a transformer? I'm telling you, there's every kind of transformer you want, and we're talking dozens of them from Antique Electronic Supply. Just put that into Google, Antique Electronic Supply, and boy, their catalog is about as thick as the DX Engineering catalog today. It's huge.
Well, you know, when we were younger, you just had to go to the local drugstore. And sometimes local supermarket, they had a U-Test'em, you know, tube tester. You remember those? And they had a stock of tubes underneath and a big old guide to tell you what you could substitute one for the other for. And my goodness, I don't know. See, now I miss that real bad, you know, but, we don't buy television sets with tubes in them anymore. We don't buy radios with tubes in them anymore. So it's like, but that was, gosh, that was a beautiful time. Because, you know, I remember one time having a little hi-fi, web core Wi-Fi, hi-fi, and the thing had gotten, something happened, I don't know, the tube went out, and so went down to the drugstore and took the tube and tested it, and it tested bad. I tested all the tubes, and the one tested bad, so I went to get one that didn't have it. So I looked at the tube substitution guide, got a substitute, and took it home and plugged all the tubes in. And it just didn't sound right. I mean, it worked, you know, but it didn't sound right. You know, so I had to wait, you know, a week or two before I could get the exact tube that went in it. And I can't remember how. I think I went downtown Detroit or something and got, went down there to some electronics store. But you mentioned a Hallicrafters SX99, okay? And my first general coverage receiver that was a commercial receiver was the SX100.
Oh, boy.
And I never knew the difference between... I would see 99s, and I would say, that looks exactly like the 100. The 100 might have a little bit more chrome on it or something, but all the knobs were the same. Everything was in the same position. So what was the difference between those two receivers? Do you know?
Yeah, huge. The SX85 and the SX99 were pretty much the same. Very simplistic receiver, but they just had a BFO. And when sideband started coming in, Bill Halligan stepped it up with the SX100. And yes, it was a beautiful receiver. It had this etched chrome front on it, but it had selectable single sideband filters, the product detectors. That was the huge difference. It was also a whole different tube lineup. Audio was better, and the front end was a little bit better, but the main thing was that it had selectable single sideband, so you could listen to lower sideband or upper sideband and a CW filter. That was all in the SX100, and then he just kept going. And probably one of the top ones that he built in that line was the SX88, and those things are going for five figures today. It's crazy. And then the other side of the coin, he went to the SX115, the SX115. And I have an SX115 paired up with an HT37 transmitter that I've had since new in 1962. Well, and it's still on air. It was a great piece.
Well, I had the HT37. And I love that transmitter. It was 6146s in the final, and they're big. These are boat anchor radios, you know, and but it had phasing modulation on it. And I know when you'd get you'd null that carrier out, and people used to just go on and on about how beautiful the audio sounded on that HT37. And
that was pretty much the same circuit that Wes Shum brought to the industry in 1948. Wes Shum, he was an incredible guy and did a lot of things most of his stuff was in security and stuff like that in the late 40s after the war. But he was a ham, and he started messing around with some transmitters that could transmit without a carrier. That was single sideband. And he figured, and this was kind of crazy, he could put on the same frequency, one of us could be on lower sideband and one be on upper sideband. And that was his theory, because AM, it takes up so much room, and he figured this would happen. Well, yeah, it happened, but the problem is you just can't have the opposite sidebands on the same frequency. There's just too much distortion between them. But it took off, and it took off like crazy. He would build these little kits up in Chicago where he lived. He'd go to Hamfest up around the Midwest and sell these kits for not very much money, and you could put together a single sideband transmitter that was on $39.99, but it was on upper sideband, so he could get by with that up at that band edge. That is how single sideband came to be. Then he built a transmitter called the 10B, or 10A. And the 10A was a phasing rig. That's how they got rid of the other sideband. That's how they got rid of the carrier. Two signals out of phase, what do you get? Nothing, or at least 40, 50 dB down. And I become infatuated with that whole works when I got into it with Larry. And that was my first single sideband transmitter. I built a 10B. And then we changed the output coil to 50 megacycles. And we built a little aluminum box with a 6U8 in it and a 36 megacycle crystal. You mix 36 and 20 meter 14. What do you have? 50 megacycles. That's how we did it. And so I was just over the top. I didn't go to school much. I didn't have time for school. I was playing the organ at the Fox, doing extremely well. I just barely got out of high school because I had all of this going on. And then it was really interesting. This is a great story. I love to share this. I have trouble personally. This is not a braggadocious thing. That's one of the things I'm very cautious about. I've been extremely blessed to be in some crazy right places at the right time, and I love to share it because this can all happen to you if you just follow the tracks. That's what I did. In 1959, I built a 6 2 Thunderbolt from Johnson. This is a 1,000 watt amplifier for 6 2 meters, 4 CX 250Bs, two of them. And it was, first of all, it was my first my first touch with 3,000 watts of voltage. But anyway, I made it, no problem. It was great. I drove it with that 10B that was on 6 meters, and then I built a transferter to take 6 meters to 2 meters. And I got a phone call from a guy one day, Ted, and he said, "Is that you the guy that's got that kilowatt on single sideband on VHF?" And I said, "Yes, sir." "Well, this is Bob Drake." I'm going, "What?" to myself. He said, "And this is Bob Drake of the Drake Receiver Company." And I'm going, "Whoa." I said, "What can I do for you, sir?" He said, "Well, we have this little club out here. We hold meetings once a year, and we share all of our energies and our newfound technologies, and we would love to have you come and talk to us about how you did this transmitter." Because you got to understand, there wasn't anybody on sideband in those days on VHF. There was about 10 or 12 of us in the country, thanks to Larry Burrows at KMOX teaching me how to do this. So I had a friend I had worked on 2 meters locally. It was about 30 miles down the pike in southern Illinois. And I was telling the guys one night, I've been invited to go to Dayton to their little meeting. Because I didn't know. I didn't know. I just heard it was some kind of little meeting they had. And one of my friends said, oh, my gosh. He says, I wanted to go to this. They've been doing this for a couple of years. So he said, I'll come up in my Bonanza, and we'll fly out to Dayton, Ohio, and go to that little club meeting. That's exactly what we did. And you talk about this. I was a 19-year-old kid just over the top. He had a KWM-2 in the dashboard of this airplane and a trailing wire antenna. I think it was about 200 feet. We could reel it into whatever frequency we were on. Think about that, working aeronautical mobile on 20-meter side. This was ridiculous for me. Oh, my God. I'd pinch myself to make sure. But I was blessed to be in these spots. Okay, we get to Dayton. What is it? It was the Dayton Hamvention. And it was held for the first few years, held in the Biltmore Hotel, downtown Dayton. And they took, on one of the floors, they took all the furniture out of the rooms. And they had in one room all the Collins guys. The next room was Bob Drake and the Drake stuff, Wes Shum and the Central Electronics, Bill Halligan and the Hallicrafters, Carl Moseley and the Moseley antenna. This went on and on. It was just outrageously wild for me because you read about these guys in the magazines, and now you're here talking to them, listening to them explain their equipment. And then there was this little kid from Marissa, and I had to do a workshop to show them what I did and how did you do this and what happened. And, of course, I give Larry Burroughs all the credit, and away we went. But I did build it. He wouldn't build it for me. But so much I learned, so much. It just, you couldn't go to college and learn that kind of stuff. And that was what was driving me. And at the same time, all of that's going on, my music career at the Fox Theater and playing concerts around the country on Saturdays and Sundays, it was just an outrageous time. Well, at the Dayton Hamvention in 1959, this guy comes to me and he said, we've been looking for somebody like you. This guy was a Brit. He was from the UK. And I got to tell you, this little kid from Marissa, I was pretty enamored with his accent and he was cool. And he said, would you be prepared to do a test with your kilowatt of 2 meter sideband? And of course, the answer is yes. No is not in my vocabulary, most things. He sent the antenna to me, and I had these loving parents. I cannot give my parents enough credit. They let me do all of these nutty, crazy things. But as it turned out, it wasn't really nutty and crazy, but it was like, whoa, this is real-time radio. I had a 110-foot Rhone beside the house with a 36-foot-long Telerex, 15 elements on 2 meters. And then I had another one, 36-foot-long, with 11-element wide space on 6 at 110 feet.
And you owned the HOA in your neighborhood, right?
There was no stupid HOA. And the deal is that what's coming next is incredibly crazy. There was a lot, an empty lot. And even today, I go back to look once in a while at the old home, town. That lot still empty. And in the middle of that lot, next to our parents' home, we put up the J-beam that they sent from England. It was 50 foot high on a 50 foot tower, but the boom was a 50 foot tower because it held 128 elements of 2 meter array, 128 elements of J-beam on 2 meters, driven by a kilowatt amplifier, Johnson 6 and 2, driven by my homebrew 6 and 2 meter sideband transmitter. The receiver at that time was a Collins 75A1, and I changed that out pretty quick to a 51J3. And just those kind of things just drove me to incredible heights. I went nuts. I couldn't get enough.
Well, you know, I know all these listeners are sitting on the edge of their chair, You got to tell us what you did with it. How did it perform? Who did you talk to? How far would it go?
Well, in 1962, I was talking to my friend Bob Cooper, W5KHT in those days. He lived in Oklahoma City, and he had up a dish. He had gotten a six-foot dish from a surplus. See, there was a lot of surplus gear. That's another thing. We could have a whole night about that. This is what drove so many of us, because we could go down and buy a 200-watt transmitter, VHF transmitter, for $50 or sometimes $5 for nothing, because they were all surplus stuff. And he had gotten a six-foot dish and put together a two-meter sideband rig. He and I had been talking, and he took that same design that Larry Burrows from KMOX taught me years back from then. And we were talking via moon bounce in 1962, and it was amazing because I knew nothing about all of the stuff that was really up over our head. You know, just a kid from Marissa, and boy, did I learn it fast. But then I would talk to people all over the Midwest, even sometimes down into Arizona. And this was all like ground wave, because the bands were open like crazy. But then there's another side point to this story. You have to understand that while I'm doing all of this, I was very fortunate that I played the organ. In 1959, I started playing in a five-star restaurant. I built a pipe organ, a theater organ, in that restaurant. And I played six nights a week, 4 hours a night. But that got me home at midnight. And then a lot of people say, "Whoa, how come you didn't go to bed?" You get off work at 5 o'clock and go to bed? Heck no. So I would be on the air from midnight to maybe 4 or 5 in the morning and get back up at noon. I still had 4 or 5 hours to build and experiment. And my life was two channels. Lots of ham radio building, experimenting, and playing the theater organ in the restaurant. Well, this restaurant in St. Louis, it was in the largest Holiday Inn in the chain in 1958 or 9. And there were 600 rooms on one floor. Across the street, when I sat at the console at the three-manual theater organ that I had built, when I looked up over the music rack, I saw the Mosley Antenna Company sign. They were right across the street in St. Louis, Lindbergh Avenue, at the airport. So I'd go in there early, every couple months, to see what they were doing. And one day I went in and I saw them building receivers. I'm going, "What going on here?" And W0BD, John Clemens, worked on the Mercury project at Boeing. At that day, it wasn't Boeing. It was McDonnell Aircraft, not even McDonnell Douglas. He was an aerospace engineer working on the capsule across the airport, and he stopped one day and sold them this receiver he had built called the CM1. I had to have one of those. Well, I still have it. I'm on the air with it every day. It's one of the coolest sounding AM receivers. John's become a really good friend of mine, but here's where I'm going with this. That was in 1959, 1960, 61. They were working on the first space capsule that was built at that McDonnell Aircraft manufacturing place. And every once in a while, the original 7 astronauts would come and spend the night at the Holiday Inn here across the street and sit in and have dinner at the 5-star restaurant and listen to my pipe organ playing and playing all the good stuff that we, same kind of music we have here on WTWW. In fact, a couple of shows I did, Ted, were recordings of some of those nights. But anyway, I became acquaintance, I guess you could say, because he'd come in every couple of months for training. Well, Alan Shepard would come and sit on the bench with me after he would finish his dinner. he was very involved in the pipe organ because he said my father had a pipe organ in our home and he woke me up every morning playing it. So I was really in tune. So we become pretty good friends. And then I started talking to them in between my breaks. I go sit down with the 7 original astronauts and told them, I showed them some pictures of this antenna. And Alan said, can we borrow that? And I said, what do you mean? You want to ship it to Houston? No. He says, you have a phone patch? I said, yeah, I do. He said, we would like to test our shots. He said, we know. Now, you got to understand, they didn't have computers yet. He said, not any kind that was viable, I guess. He said, listen, we'd like to just do a shot and make sure that all of our calculations are right. Let's see how fast it goes up, how fast it comes down, all that. So what they did is about 2 o'clock in the morning, one morning they sent me a tone over the phone that would key my transmitter, and then they in Houston were listening to the signal as it came back down. And you know, we do crazy things, and we do some really fun things. To me, that was probably a highlight of my young career because, my gosh, I'm working with NASA. This is like, what? And I have a menu with all the 7 original astronauts signing it. And I felt really good about that because it was all ham radio. I didn't go to college. I'm not an engineer. I'm a crazy theater organist, built lots of pipe organs, but I built a ton of transmitters and receivers and all kinds of gadgets and boxes and stuff. And it drove me just wildly to finally give up the playing the organ after about 12 years nightly. And I didn't give it up. I still play, but nightly, you know, playing in restaurants and stuff. Now I just go around and play concerts when I can or want to or have to. And every Saturday night on WTWW, how fun is that? I thank you for bringing that back into my life on a regular basis. But anyway, I opened a little music shop in 1965, and I didn't know what was happening. I just didn't want to play anymore, and I wanted to be home more. And this is a story that could go on for hours, and we're going to run through it really quickly, in that it became a major part of the entertainment industry again. It was that crazy ham that had a soldering iron, and people like REO Speedwagon and Michael McDonald and the Grateful Dead and The Who and Joe Walsh, and the list goes on and on and on and on. Because I was a guy that could fix their stuff. Townsend always put it really cool, Pete Townsend of The Who. He said, hey, the guy's got a soldering iron. He makes it sound good, and he can drive the truck. Because I was the straightest guy that these guys ever saw, I'll tell you that. Still have never tasted beer or smoked a cigarette. But what great friends they became, and my soldering iron was the instigator. And we had an incredible career in the music business, and we had a fantastic career in the music industry, building, designing, and ended up, my life just went in circles and circles, but it ended up in about 8 years ago. Heil Sound is the only manufacturer in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They have a huge room right beside Les Paul's room. It's on the technical floor, the 3rd floor of the Rock Hall in Cleveland. And I have to tell everybody, it is the most honorable, most humble, and the most blessed thing that could happen, because no one else is there. And I said, what? There's larger companies, they do more things than I, and all of this, and they've been around forever. And the curator said, yes, but you brought us new technologies, the quad system for The Who, the talk box for Frampton and Walsh, the first 20,000 watt PA, the first mixer that could do 4 channels and do quad and everything else. And a lot of that stuff is in that display at the Rock Hall. And I never thought about it like that. I'm a ham. You guys are the same way. You do things, you build things, you have the fun with them. You don't do it because you're going to get your picture somewhere or somebody's going to talk about you. You do it because you love it, and you do it because it's just part of you. And ham radio has driven, just driven me all these years.
And you know something? The other part of this, Bob, is you can't stop doing it.
Well, probably true. Because here we are, still doing stuff.
But now you were doing this. You were with these big names, rock and roll. You were out. I know you were involved in helping, like the Who, and I don't know who else, but their PA systems. There's some stories about all that. But it surprised me because evidently you kept it straight and you never got involved with, you know, taking a chainsaw to a hotel room.
Oh, but I was there. I would always get a room that was far down the way, you know, and because I really mean that. I love to have a good time, but I never liked the smell of alcohol. And you know where that came from? Going into these restaurants. I started playing in a restaurant when I was 14 years old in Freeburg, Illinois. And about 40 miles southeast of St. Louis, out in the coal fields, 10 miles north of Marissa, where I grew up, I would go in there in the daytime to do something on the organ, and I would get sick. I mean, the smell, the rotten smell of smoke and booze that had been there the night before. That'll stop you cold as a 14-year-old kid. I'd go home after playing each night, and I'd have to wash my eyes because they burn so bad. That's why. And I just never took a like to it. I love Dr. Pepper and iced tea. Does that work? It does for me. And definitely no smoke or any of that. But that, I'm not going to say, well, you can't do that. I'm not on some kind of platform. No. And it was Townsend that always told everybody, hey, he can drive the truck. And we became friends with these guys. The Grateful Dead. The Grateful Dead. There's an incredible story. We just don't have time to go through all these.
Oh, yes, we do. This is QSO. This is where we go all the way to the wall. So you talk and you tell whatever you want to do. You have fun. And we don't have time restraints. We don't have any idea what time means when we get on this show. So you tell your Grateful Dead story because we want to hear it.
It's another part of that whole deal. And it all started with the Fox. The Fox Theater was in my life three incredible important times. Of course, I told you I played the organ there for, oh gosh, on and off about 12 years. And still do once in a while. But in those days, the organ was playing every night. And I quit playing every night in 1965, late. And I opened this little music shop. Well, along about 67, I was in St. Louis one day. I was 50 miles up the road. And I thought, oh, I'll go see my old buddy, George Bales. He was the stage manager that would push the button to bring the organ up out of the pit. And I rolled into the back of the Fox. And here's all these big speakers. There's four of them out where the trash dump is. And I'm going, what are you doing? I go into Georgia, what's happening? Well, we're putting a new PA in here. I said, really? What's going on out there? Oh, he said, we're waiting for the trash guy. He's going to come and pick. I stopped him. I said, wait a minute. I'm a ham. We don't throw anything away, okay?
Oh, boy.
No. Can I have those? What those were 1933 RCA. Harry Olson designed bass bins. They were 8 foot by 6 foot by 4 foot. And there were four of them behind the screen of the original sound system that was in the Fox Theater. And I said, wow. So I went and rented a truck, took them to Marissa. Now, you got to understand, I'm a Hammond organ dealer at this time. I'm not playing around with any rock and roll shows, nothing. I'm a Hammond organ dealer and just still dyed in the wool with organs. But I put these together. I rented an old warehouse in Marissa, and I built this incredible hi-fi. To me, it was just a big hi-fi. Happened to end up being a 20,000-watt hi-fi. Macintosh amps and all kinds of wonderful JBL drivers. But these beautiful, well, they were just plywood, but to me, they were something. 16-foot folded horns. They would get down to 15 cycles and rattle the innards of you. And so I put it together. Well, at that time then, I started renting Hammond organs to the Kiel Auditorium in St. Louis. They would have shows come in there. And the shows that in those days were mainly from the Grand Ole Opry right there in Nashville. You see, in those days, 1967, 68, you never saw Dolly Parton. You couldn't see Little Jimmy Dickens. You couldn't see Porter Wagoner. You had to go to Nashville and see them. They weren't on television, just rare little things. So what they did to start building up the popularity to a new generation, they started going around the country on the weekends with a thing called the Cavalcade of Stars, and they would come to the Kiel Auditorium. Well, I would be renting Hammond organs to them the first year, but the PA in the Kiel was a joke. It was little column speakers about 5 foot high with 4-inch speakers in them. But that place was built back in the 30s. That was it. They just had a, you know, for speaking, for clubs and stuff. Well, when the entertainers started coming in, so one of the shows, I took half, just a little bit of this PA with me, and I set it up, and oh my gosh, the promoters and the manager go, whoa, would you do this for us? Could you do that? Well, one other guy said to me, hey, I've got a little band in Michigan, and I want to bring him into Ohio and do some tour, a little tour. Would you want to, or could you bring a little bit of this PA? I don't need all of it. So I said, hey, why not? I've never been on tour, but okay. So a couple of guys that I had by then I had hired as roadies took this PA to Ohio for a little, it was about 6 or 8 gigs. And the first night, I didn't know who these guys were because I didn't know a lot of the bands at that time. And we did the first night. The second night, right as we were getting the sound check together, we discovered that the lead guitarist and me were hams. That's amateur radio operators. And his call was WB6ACU, and his name is Joe Walsh. It formed a friendship that no one can sever. We have had such a life since then because Joe finally had a guy to go work with him. He says, I want to do this, I want to do that. Well, no is not in either one of our vocabularies, and we were just doing crazy stuff. And that band was the James Gang. Well, Joe left that band. He wanted to form a new band, a solo band called Barnstorm. And he had this song called Rocky Mountain Way. And in it had this little device that he had heard in a studio in Nashville from a first time, I mean, just a big time guitar player. And Pete Drake had a little gadget that he had built, a little 3-inch speaker and a hose, and he played his steel guitar through it, and he had a song called Forever Yours in 1950. It was a big hit. Joe was infatuated. He had went to that studio and heard it. But what are you going to do with a big, loud rock band? So Joe and I went to our plant in Marissa one weekend, took a 250-watt JBL driver and built the Heil talk box. We didn't know what it was going to be. It was a talk box for Joe. Well, he did that song, and it became very popular, Rocky Mountain Way. So I thought, maybe we should open a plant and start building those, which we did. Peter Frampton was with, by then we had started doing tours with these big systems. And we're talking Humble Pie, Jake Giles, ZZ Top, Ted Nugent, on and on and on. It was just amazing because we were the first guys to have a major sound system that sounded good and had somebody that kind of knew what you could do with it. How did that guy learn all that? Ham radio. And I loved it because I would get to a lot of these places, and I mean, we were just blowing everybody's mind because they had never experienced. Noticed I didn't say heard, experienced that kind of thing of a huge sound system in a big arena. And they would first question, wow, where'd you go to school? How'd you learn all this? Where'd this come from? Well, ham radio. No. Where'd you go to school? I said, ham radio. And they wouldn't get it until I would sit them down and say, look, we built hundreds of things, gadgets, antennas, microphone preamps and microphone EQs and transmitters and all of this. We built it. We had to. You couldn't go out and buy some of this stuff. And as a kid, I learned how to do it there. They still didn't understand, but okay, so what? Thing of it is, we were out there doing all these crazy, crazy things. Well, one day, I get this call from George Bales. Here comes the fox for the third time. Played the organ first, then I got the speakers from him. Here we are 2 years, 3 years later. Hey, he says, you still have those speakers? And I said, yeah. He said, talk to this guy. He said, this band came in here today to the Fox. They're supposed to play here tonight, but their PA didn't show up. I said, what do you mean it didn't show up? Well, he said the sound man was on probation out of California, and he wasn't supposed to be out of the state, and they were going to they only had a little run of about 6 or 8 dates, and they thought they could sneak it under. And the sound man happened to own all the gear and the truck. So the FBI and the drug agents heard about it, and they go to the New Orleans warehouse and sit in the back row and let the Grateful Dead play their concert. And at the end of the show, the band comes on to St. Louis. They didn't have cell phones, and they left Owsley behind to pack up and drive the truck on up. Well, he packed it all up, but just as he padlocked the back of his truck, they padlocked him, took him and the gear out of there. And so at 4 o'clock the next day, here comes the band on the stage at the Fox. Where's Owsley? There's nothing here. What's going on? They called back to their office and soon find out he was on probation. Owsley was one of the founders, inventors of LSD, and the feds didn't like it because he had jumped parole, and that was it. So what do you do? George Bales hands the phone to Jerry Garcia, and Jerry says, hey, man, this guy says you got a big PA. What is it? And I told him, you know, JBL mid-range, JBL 075 tweeters, Harry Olsen 16-foot bends, Macintosh amps, Blondjevin consoles. I laid it all out. He said, you got all this and it works? I said, yes, sir. He said, get it up here. I said, I can't be there. I'm 50 miles. I can't be there till about 9 o'clock. That's okay. We'll keep them entertained, and boy, did they. And the people that went to that show that night was a historic night because they got to hear him play a lot of stuff sitting out on top of the – I never forget walking in there that day. They were all sitting out on top of the seats, those beautiful velvet seats, all singing and dancing and other things. But anyway, we did the show, and it was incredible. And if you are real interested in this whole Heil Sound story, you put into your Google the night rock and roll sound was born. Somebody was at that show and years later published this great article, and every single word of it is true. A lot of times things are written by some of these characters and they either leave out good parts or embellish it. This one is right on. And it's called The Night Rock and Roll Sound Was Born. you'll read the whole thing. It was a great piece of history because from there we hit the front page of Billboard magazine that this little music shop in Marissa, Illinois has the Grateful Dead touring contract. And from then it went nuts. Everybody was calling us, all the big names, because nobody else had a good high-powered working sound system. They were just little columns.
I want to ask you a question. Is the Olsen fella, is he by any chance any connection to him and the Olsen electronics chain that came up later?
No. You know, the RCA 77D and the 74D, all those great ribbon mics that you saw in those days, of course, you talked through a lot of them. That was designed by Harry Olsen. He was the chief engineer at RCA.
I've got three of the DX77s or 77DX. I don't know which way it is. Anyways, I got three of those that I've collected over the years. Mine are not in good shape in terms of operation, but they sure are beautiful to look at.
I have a 44 and I have a couple of those. But however, if we can probably announce it now, but at Dayton, you're going to be able to purchase our retro of that. It's called the PR-77. And there's a few of them floating out there now, prototypes. But oh my gosh, I've been working 2 years on this project. And the PR-77 is number one, gorgeous. It's an exact replica of the RCA 77D. It's got our PR-40 and 35 element in it. Oh my gosh, it's really, really great. We're very proud. It took a long time, but you're going to be hearing a lot of those on the air.
Well, you know, those mics are classics, and I worked so many stations. I've never had a 44, but I've got the 377s. But honestly and truly, folks may you look at these mics and you say, oh my God, they must sound wonderful, and in their own way they do. But the PR-40 sounds so much better than an RCA 77. It's just the nostalgia of the 77. So if you can make a 77 body sound like a PR-40, then you're going to have a real winner. I can tell you that right now.
We did. We put the PR-40 in our retro. It took us a couple of years to get it right because it was a... I went through three different tooling companies to get it right. The screen is tough to do, but we did it, and my God, it sounds great. So, yeah, we'll start promoting that because it's now in production here in Fairview Heights, where I am tonight. But anyway,
I was going to say, don't forget in your conversation about the PA systems and all the things you've been involved in. And don't feel like you're rushed, you know, tell the stories because we've got the time. Talk a little bit or don't leave out the story of you and Paul Klipsch. I thought that was always a very good example of synergy, especially where ham radio meets somebody like Paul Klipsch. And so don't leave that part out. I want you to tell that again.
You can't talk about it until we did what we just did. After hitting the front page of Billboard, I touched on it a bit. I mean, we were just bombarded with phone calls. We didn't have text, thank goodness. Didn't have email. We had telephones. You could actually pick up a phone and talk to somebody. Isn't that wonderful? And I still do that. I am not a lover of all that other crap. I do it, but no. Nothing like a good old telephone to talk to somebody. I pick up a phone one day. This would have been about 70, it was 72. We had just finished the first leg of the Who tour, the Who's Next. That's an incredible story, too. We'll come back to it. Anyway, the guy said, "That you, Heil?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Who's this?" "There's a Klipsch here." And I'm going to myself, I'm going, this is God of audio on the other end of his phone. I said, "What can I do for you?" He said, You got the 20,000 watt PA, right?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it's out on the road, but some of it's here." He said, "I want to come and see it. You got a cornfield?" He was a real coarse old dude, such a genius. He said, "You got a cornfield I can come and crash in?" And I said, "I'm sorry?" "Oh, dang it, you don't have an airport in that little stupid town, Bry. You got a cornfield I'll come and crash in. I want to fly up and see you." I said, "Well, come 4 miles south to Sparta, Illinois Airport. It's a nice airport." So he did. Spent the whole day with me. It was amazing. I figured he was just going to cut me off at the knees because you guys have to understand, I was not an engineer. I am not an engineer. I'm a ham radio operator with a soldering iron and not afraid to try anything. As I tell so many hams, so many, they'll say, oh, I don't know. You know, tell me this will work. You think this will work? I said, just do it. If it blows up, great. And you know what? 9 times out of 10, it won't blow up. So, hey, good luck. Just try it. Well, Paul comes to Marissa all day long. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? How come you did this? I said, I just did it. I don't know. I just tried. I did it. He said, there were no books. I said, no, there aren't any books written and stuff like this. He put me in his airplane after the day in Marissa, touring around the plant and seeing all of our stuff, and took me to his home in Hope, Arkansas. We spent the night. The next morning, took me out to his personal lab. It reminded me of a one-room schoolhouse, and I kind of think it might have been. But it was on a 25-acre ammunition depot. He was doing a thing in the war that was amazing. And after the war, they gave him this wonderful operation of the lab he had built inside this little school and so on. And I spent the whole day, and it was just absolutely a turnaround in my life because I learned so much. Did I learn it that day? No. But he pointed me to things. He would prove things to me and listen to this, see how that works, and do it. Fletcher Munson curve. You know about the Fletcher Munson? No, I don't. No, he said, okay, write all this down. You go back and look up the audio encyclopedia. Well, I had one of them. This is a book that's about 5 inches thick, a regular book size, but it's about 5 inches thick, thousands of pages. That's where you learn audio. And because we didn't have Google. And he said, go in and search all of the Bell telephone experiments about what frequencies do you need to make the human ear understand the difference of an F and an S and a P or a B. And I can do this right here. This is quite a neat little experiment I do. When the phone company first started and they didn't know about all this back in the late 20s, this is what they had. They had something that sounded like this. And it didn't sound very good, but all the frequencies were right from one end to the other. What was wrong with it? They couldn't figure it out because all of the electronics were working. Why did they have such a horrible sounding signal? They put Dr. Fletcher and Dr. Munson on the curve. Write this down. Dr. Fletcher, Dr. Munson, and go look up the Fletcher-Munson curve, and you are going to discover what they discovered. They discovered that the human ear is not even close to flat. We have some huge holes. Our ears, when you go in and do a chart of our ears, any of you, and I had these guys, well, I have perfect pitch high. I don't hear like, we all hear alike. God made us all alike in that respect. Oh, you might listen a little louder or a little softer, but you have that same problem. You have these big holes where things are just awful. So what do you do with it? You have to equalize it. And then you get these guys, these hard-headed, just hard-headed old dudes. I don't need no darn equalizer. I don't need that high. I'll get away. Well, everything you have, big surprise coming here, everything you own, from your cell phone, your car radio, your TV, your record player, your tape recorder, anything with audio has been equalized for you. No, it might not have a bass and treble or mid or whatever. There are no adjustments, but Dr. Fletcher and Dr. Munson have schooled all of the design engineers. What you are listening to right now from my voice has a certain curve. And if I don't have that, this is what you're going to get. This is what your ears are hearing. And the sad part is that there are so many that will just tell me to go away. That's not the way I hear. Well, I got news for you. And I learned all these many, many things. Then he got me into phasing. Oh, my God. I went nuts. And I became a very good friend with Paul, making trips down to Hope, Arkansas, spending time, calling him on the phone. And we really, really liked each other because he loved my ability to not be afraid to try anything, because that's the way he was. He says, I'm going to show you something, Heil. I'm going to take you downstairs in this lab. And he said, we can only go about three steps down because it's just full of prototype speakers that I've built over the years, and they didn't work. And he stood halfway up this staircase, looking down, pointing. Now, that one over there, I tried this, but I had the angle wrong where the front panel was sitting. I had to change that angle. That one over there, the speaker was mounted wrong. This one, I had it too long, too big, the panel that does the refractions. He said, and went on and explained a lot of these carcasses in the basement. And I said, well, you throw these away? Oh, no. He said, these are my teachers. I come down here and talk to them every once in a while. he was just such a great guy. I learned so much from him.
But wasn't a lot of learning on your end that you talked about some time ago, was the fact that you were using so much power that it shocked him, and not electrically, but I mean, he was just shocked at how much power you were using. And by the time you and him and the friendship, you know, started to blossom, you know, he was showing you and telling you things about how little power could do basically the same thing, or something along that line. I remember that really impressed me when you were telling that story at some point.
Paul Klipsch was an efficiency freak. He was an efficiency freak. I say that lovingly. After all of that first day, he took me upstairs and he showed me his corner horn, the K horn, very famous, famous hi-fi speaker. Paul Klipsch practically invented hi-fi. And what he did is he built this true 16-foot horn. To get 30 cycles, you got to have 16 foot. And for all these little clowns to get their little boxes that are 6 inches square and tell you that it's going to do 15 or 30, that's a lie. It's a downright dirty lie. It can't be done. Oh, they can get maybe 30.2, you know, they can get that, but they can't get it all from 30 cycles all the way through 50, 60, 100, 200, 1,000, 10,000. They can't do all of that. They're going to have huge holes, and that's how they do it. They do it electronically. And there's one company that I absolutely despise because they came on with these little bitty speakers. And oh my, I remember Paul, it was kind of the beginning of that then. He would just come unglued because it would do one of the frequencies in an octave. Well, what about the rest of them? And he was a big pipe organ freak. That's another thing we got together. Because when you do a run in a bass pedals of an organ, especially a theater pipe organ, you're doing somewhere down to 16 cycles, and if you're doing octaves, you're doing 16, 32, 16, 32, do a fifth, you get into all these different frequencies. Put on some of these junky-ass little speakers that you see around today. Oh, isn't that great? Half of them aren't as loud as the other one, so you get this real uneven, and that's what Paul taught me was about efficiency. We go upstairs. He's got a K-horn. It's a 15-inch speaker that he designed and a radial horn made out of wood, and it's put in the corner. And why the corner was you needed 8 foot of wall on that side and 8 foot of wall on the other side from the corner. That completed the 16-foot, and that was part of your room. Your room became the speaker, and he was just over the top if you ever saw the speaker move. when you apply power. Because if you see a speaker move, my friend, you got phase distortion. And you're going to, oh, it sounds okay. Yeah, but if you didn't have that, if you ever get the chance to experience a K-horn, you'll see what I mean. It is just amazing. So he said, here, take the controls. He had a little 10-watt amplifier, a little Marantz 10-watt amplifier, and he had a strobe tied to the audio oscillator that I plugged into that. And the sides of this K-horn was plexiglass, so we could watch that speaker. And we took a sound pressure meter out 36 inches in front of this speaker. We were running about 110 dB at 16 cycles. And if you've never experienced that true, not harmonically, that's how all these little junky speakers do it. They do harmonic. No, we're talking about solid. 16 cycles. It's just like somebody taking a sledgehammer to your stomach and you're 36 inches in front of this thing and the speaker is not moving. And I went to measure the power, and the power was 1 watt. I couldn't believe it. I mean, how do you do this? Paul Klipsch did it. He taught a lot of us how to do it. And just with 1, 2, 3 watts, you can do all this. And I went back home in my 20,000-watt PA. I rebuilt all the boxes. With his design, he helped me. I'd call him and ask him to do that. He'd give me all the dimensions to do this, do that. You got to understand, Harry Olson's box was built in 1929, 30, 31, right in there. And it was great. But Paul did it better. And we went in and rescheduled all that. He turned me on to the people that built his speakers and gave them permission to make them for me, branded as Heil speakers. Heil Celeste, and my PA that I was using with all these bands, To Who, Humble Pie, Walsh, Frampton, ZZ Top, all these bands. I mean, there were dozens of them. And you got to understand, in 1971, a lot of people had never heard of these bands. They were just beginning their careers, and they had this great sound system to play with. And this crazy, stupid ham that would do anything I wanted. We weren't afraid. and we took this thing out, and instead of it running 20,000 watts, it ran about 8,000. And that was just a miracle. And we got better coverage, much cleaner audio. The amplifiers were running much cleaner because they didn't have to run all that power. Paul Klipsch, I love Paul Klipsch. He was my great mentor, and I miss him a lot. And from there, it went to, we could be on the rest of this story, which carries on, that is really nuts. I work with Ray Dolby. Yes, the Ray Dolby. I really got infatuated with the satellite industry. In 1989, there again, ham radio. Who else can find a satellite at 22,000 miles in the sky? A ham. And it would have been about 80, 81. I got involved in that market. In 1989, Heil Sound was the satellite dealer of America, selling thousands of those down in the mid part and southern part of Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, in the hills where people couldn't have television. When I say that today, people say, what are you talking about? There were towns that were out in the middle of nowhere, Pinckneyville, Illinois, County Seat, Mount Vernon, Illinois, all in through there, Marissa, down in through the along the Mississippi River, Prairie du Rocher on the other side, Perryville, Missouri, Ironton, all of that. They had no TV. They didn't have TV. Well, you guys did because you could pick it up. You were only 10, 15 miles from the TV station. But when satellite came in, new ball game. And then I started in 1985 going to the conventions. They hired me, the people that built the dishes, they hired me to come and teach classes at the Grand Ole Opry Hotel. We were there twice a year. Then we would go twice a year to Las Vegas at Bally's in the parking lot. There would be sometimes 20, 30 dishes. We're talking 10, 12-foot dishes. This is a real-time satellite, long before K-band, which was the DirecTV. But I would teach the TV dealers mostly, and a lot of them are hams, how to find the satellite and how to make things work. Then in 1985, Ray Dolby, got Paul Clips on the mind, I never can forget him. Ray Dolby had introduced a prototype of a thing called ProLogic, because I had been going to these conventions and setting up a little theater, I mean complete with red velvet seats and motorized curtains and all that, back as early as 83. But I had really cool speakers. I built JBL front loads with radial horns and 075 tweeters and just great amplifiers of all kinds of Macintosh mostly. But we really didn't have great preamps and stuff. And Dolby calls me and said, could I bring my prototype? We're going to be able to take those two signals out of the back of your satellite receiver, the back of your VCR. Now listen closely, everybody. You got a left and a right. You know, the red and the white. They come out of there and go into the amplifier, right? Well, he had this receiver that he called ProLogic, and we took those two signals and plugged them into that booger, and we ended up with four out. We had left front, right front, speech audio in the front, and rears. How did he do that? He only had two signals. And they did it all with phasing. We set that up at the first show. I'll never forget it. And it was ironic that was the show they had planned to give us the award, which I was, again, so blessed to get. My gosh, I don't do these things for awards. I do these things because I love doing them and sharing all this great technology that wasn't going on at the time, but I knew it was there. Well, how did he get that? How did Dolby do that? They did it with phasing. Here comes my wonderful subject I learned from Wes Shuman, the 20A and the 10B and the 10A back in my ham radio. Phasing. Well, how did you do that? Here's how they did it. They would go into the studio. You've seen pictures. Had this immense orchestra playing the background of Indiana Jones left and right. The train would come across and go left to right. And the audio would go left to right. Follow it across. Okay, cool. Then here comes Harrison Ford, and his voice only comes out of the center speaker. How did they do that? They only have two signals. Well, when they recorded it, they had this big studio with the orchestra. He would be in a voice booth, and he would talk into a microphone that was out of phase. You never heard it on the left and right speakers. They entered another amplifier at the end of the ProLogic decoder that decoded that out-of-phase signal and gave you that center channel. Then they did it again for the rear channels, all about phasing. And just being able to hang around, that's an awful word to say when you're talking about Paul Klipsch and Ray Dolby and all of these incredible people in my life, Larry Burrows at CBS. I mean, it just went on and on. I learned all this stuff, and then I turned thousands, yes, thousands of TV dealers into satellite dealers in those conventions. Every once in a while, I'll get a note from one of them saying, wow, remember those days? And then in 1990, I sold my satellite division because I had been asked by the Hubbard family, Minneapolis. Stanley Hubbard Jr. had just spent $60 million to buy a license to put a satellite in the air when it went up. He was going to get the choice of where it would be. And he put it dead south. That way it would cover pretty much of the United States because it was high in the orbit and dead south. And he said, I want you to be on a test team for me. He said, we're going to be testing a small dish. It's going to be about 20 inches in diameter. It's going to be on K-band. Well, you guys know this. If you take a piece of wire and it's a, if it's 120 foot long, it's going to be resonating on 75 meters. Well, a 10-foot dish and all of its LNBs and so on resonated at 4 gigs. What happened if you made it, instead of 10 foot, made it about a foot and a half? It would resonate at 12 gigs, right? Well, that's what happened. I had this in my yard. In my back, I had two 12-footers, two 10-footers, and then this guy in my backyard. Marissa loved me. But they always knew I was doing something crazy and weird and wild and all that. Something was going to come with whatever that Heil kid was doing. I was on the test team for the Hubbard guys. And in 1994, that test team became DirecTV. They would give us test shots at sequenced times and see what we heard and what we could see on our test TVs and stuff. And so I was so enamored with the satellite division, and I got into home theater. We were doing $200,000 and $300,000 and $400,000 rooms for baseball players and doctors and lawyers and all that in the Midwest. Whole thing of motorized curtains and velvet seats and all that. And so it was just something that you can't start. I couldn't start today and say, we're going to do this. It just happened. I was blessed to be in the right time, at the right place. And one little side note about, you remember I said we had a Langevin console that we had bought. It was very expensive in those days. It was a $10,000 console, and for a kid from Marissa in 1970, let me tell you, that was a big expense, but I needed it. We had all this great PA going, but the console, nobody was building anything. Well, I did it, but it didn't work well because it was very sensitive. It was made for recording studios. You put that on a stage with 110 dB coming out of a guitar amp, it just massacred the front end and blow it up. But it was just distorted. One of the kids that was working, calling my kid, Peter Kimball, he was going to SIU Carbondale. He said, hey, I got this high school chum. He's just graduated from the University of Illinois with an electronics degree and a film sound. And he doesn't have a job yet. It was in December, half year. And he said, maybe he could help us. Here's where the ham radio in me was wanting to, but I didn't want to dig into this expensive console because I really didn't know exactly what I was doing. I could build it and all that and schlock it together, but we're talking about some really serious electronics here. So we did. We called Tom. He came to Marissa, and a long story about it, but the Reader's Digest is he rebuilt the front end of that Langevin with me. He and I worked together and got it all working. So we lowered the gain, kept all of the beautiful equalization and all of the switching and routing and so on. That guy, Tomlinson Holman, went on to work in 1982 His first job was really at Heil Sound, believe it or not. I mean, he did this job project. Then he went on to do some incredible things in his life. But in 82, he was hired by George Lucas to design and look over a thing called the Tomlinson-Holman Experiment, THX. And Tom and I are dear friends, incredible engineer, and he worked with us. So there was another incredible genius that crossed our paths, and God put us together. And
now, you know, this gets a little scary because I'm looking down here on the where I've got below my normal amateur radio setup here. I have a Central Electronics 100V that I'm staring at. Okay, so and I mean, and I know this this relates to the gentleman you were talking about earlier. Okay. And then in the den, I have an Apt-Holman preamp as one of the preamps I use on our stereo system in the den, which was developed by him, Tomlinson-Holman. I guess it's Tomlinson-Holman or Holman-Tomlinson. But it's an Apt-Holman preamp. I know you maybe you're familiar with it.
Yeah, very. Yeah, Tomlinson-Holman. That's it. He went on to start that company. He also developed a speaker company. And George Lucas, let me tell you that story. This is great. George Lucas went one time to see one of his great films. I don't remember which one it was, but this is a true story. And they sit down, and there was a scene with a train going left to right. And they went to this little theater in California, and they sat down. And the train was going on the screen left to right, but the audio was going right to left. You can imagine what went over in his mind. I went to all this work to build all this great stuff and design all this great stuff in the film, and these idiots hooked the thing up wrong. They had the left going into the right. He said, that's it. So he decided he would design his own audio, and if you were ever going to play a George Lucas film in a theater, it would be done through his own audio. And Tomlinson-Holman designed the THX, and this is really cool. He went to all of the certified THX theaters personally and made sure it was all adjusted right in the very beginning. And there you go. It's just amazing, but yep, you're right. You have a couple of his products right there.
Well, the Central Electronics piece is not his piece. It's the other fellow you were talking about. And I understand they have one like once a year they have some sort of a gathering or get together or something that goes on that involves all the Central Electronics pieces and all that. And you may know about that. I just know sketches I've heard, you know, and I don't know, is this the 100V, is that a phasing rig?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a no-tune rig. In 1956, he and Tom Batchelor, Wes Shum, and Tom Batchelor, one of his engineers, designed, you ready for this, 1956, a no-tune 500-watt linear with only one knob on it, band switch.
Oh, boy.
I have to laugh once in a while when I see all these guys and they pay all these thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for these linears that are no tune. Hey, Wes Shum, and I have mine, a 600L. I've had mine. It works great. You don't tune it. You just plug your 20A or your 100V or whatever into it. Boom, away you go. It senses where you are and you don't have any problem. He designed these couplers to do that. I have admired Wes Shum my whole life because starting at the age of 15, I found out about single sideband. I told you that story with the KMOX engineer and all that. My first piece of gear was the 10A that we changed to 2 meters and to 6 meters, and originally was on 75. But anyway. The deal is that I had never met him. And about, what was it? That's going to be coming up on 3 years. Nick Tusa was a young chap that worked with him, befriended him and worked with him. And Nick, on field day, wanted to get a bunch of us Central Electronic Vintage Audio Crazies together. And we went down to Jonesboro, Tennessee, and met for field day at Wesham's farm. He's got 28 acres there. And we had his 100V and a Drake 2B and a 600L, no tune linear, out under a tent. And we did field day with that. And Wesham was operating. It was one of the incredible times in my life because I admired him. I adored him because he was the guy that taught me so much about phasing. I coupled that then. That was my ham radio phasing experience. Then I come across Paul Klipsch, and he taught me more about it in the audio world. These guys were the mentors that I couldn't have done without them. Well, I got to spend, it would have been, 3 years ago? Yeah, coming up on three. I got to spend field day at his home, and it was just, I can't describe it. It was something I adored him all my life, and then to be able to spend a weekend with him and talk about the science and the background and the experiences, that you live for those kind of days, and unfortunately he passed away that next year, but we still do it. We did it last year. And we, meaning Nick Tusa, he's an amazing guy. And he put it all together, and we still keep it together. What we did last year, or what he did, he had we were about 60 of us from all over the country. We were all vintage transmitter characters. We saw all kinds of gear, a lot of homebrew, beautifully built stuff, and it really, really played. Just put into your Google, I'm not sure where they titled it, but if you put into their, put Nick Tusa, N-I-C-K-T-U-S-A, put into their Nick Tusa, see if it don't bring up the Central Electronics page, or just put Central Electronics, and you'll be getting all of those. There's even videos of some of that. And then we had guys that did lots of different workshops and forums. And I, of course, did one on audio. And it was quite an experience. And it's going to take place again this year. And I'm sorry, I don't have the dates, but look around.
We could look that up, and it would be good to promote it on QSO and on WTWW, because it gives us the opportunity to get the word out. And
we'll have Nick on here. I mean, you talk about history, oh buddy, that'd be a good thing to do. But anyway, it happens in July, I think, this year. But June, July, and I can't wait to be there. It's going to be fun again.
Now, you were telling a story earlier, but when you told it, you kind of left the audience hanging just a little bit, I think. And I tend to do that all the time. You know, your mind moves on. You know, you're talking about something, and the mind says, "Whoa, going over here." You were working with, and you said you were, chumming with seven of the astronauts, and you got involved with this thing that you had this huge, huge beam and a kilowatt and all that. But you talked about bouncing a signal. And you also talked about the folks at NASA wanting you to use the transmitter to test something. But I think you may have lost everybody a little bit there, because I think you were talking about moon bounce. And I just like for you to kind of sum that one up, because I think that is really a cool story. And to think that, you know, you were working with the NASA bouncing a signal off the moon. I'd like all the folks that are listening to understand this thing. I mean, I think this is outstanding.
Well, the moon's 20, you know, what we were trying to do with some of the satellites that were there, they'd already had some early satellites at 22,000 feet or wherever to be in orbits, because synchronous orbits, it stays right there all the time. It just follows you around. But They had figured out with their very antiquated computers that they had of that. Mostly, if you saw the wonderful film. Have you seen the film Hidden Figures? Oh, my gosh. You have to go see that. It's really great because that's how it happened. And these three women had figured it out when the computer couldn't. Talk about smart women. Anyway, they had figures of delay from different things, and they knew how long it was going to take to receive a signal back down on Earth, but they had no way to test it other than they were going to have to build some kind of an old big antenna or whatever. Well, here's this kid from Orissa's got one, and so what they did is used my station, and they did it remotely. I tied a phone patch, it was a Gonset phone patch, into the transmitter, and they would send a tone over the phone line, and that would key my transmitter. I had it in voice-operated relay, VOX, and when they keyed their tone over the phone line in Houston, it would turn my transmitter on, and they told me what angles and where they wanted to go, and I never got involved in it. I don't know what happened on the downlink, but they were quite happy because it proved to them their figures were right. And those are things that you just can't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to call NASA and let them shoot my signal to the moon or wherever they wanted to do it. No, it's just...
Under those circumstances, this is where you wake up in the morning and you don't really need a cup of coffee. You're running on the adrenaline of it, you know, the excitement of it, you know. And, you know, that's something I wanted to cover with you or talk to you about, and that is, you know, it's today one of the things I see that's lacking, I guess I want to say, with younger folks, and that is obsession and passion. And all of these things where, you know, and you know, you've been there, you're working on a project, and the next thing you know, it's daylight. And you're saying, wait a minute, just a little while ago, it was 7 o'clock.
That's right.
You know what I'm talking about, you know? And I think this is the magic of all this. This is the magic to get lost in it. And we were talking, you know, actually, there's two or three things we need to cover, because coming up, we have to talk about, I want to call it the AM Renaissance that you're going to be so much a part of. And I'm so glad to see, because I think that of course, I grew up with AM radio and AM broadcast radio, and I grew up working on these old RCA and Gates transmitters running on 4400s and 833s and so on and so forth. You know, so I love AM radio, and then when I was a kid, you know, my first shortwave was an old Gruno, and I could get the 40 meter band on it, and it was only about a 32nd of an inch wide, okay, but I could hear all these guys talking, you know. Yeah. And with AM coming back now, and we've got myriads, and I know this from our radio station, we have millions of people that have these little Texan radios. They're handheld, they're really cool, but a lot of them don't get sideband. So as more activity takes place on AM, those folks will have a chance to hear ham radio in action. But we'll get into that in a minute. But what I'd like to do is, one of the things you've always been very big about, I think, and that is honoring and because you just got done telling all these stories, the heritage of some of these folks that have walked among us that have been the teachers. And I think it would be good for you to kind of relate to us a little bit about the little project you had back some years ago. And I believe the guy's call was N4VMY, and his name was Bill Decker. And you did a thing a bunch of fellows there that you were working with did a thing to honor him. And I'd like for you to kind of tell a little bit about that, because I think that's an element we really need to consider honoring those people that have paved the road that we drive on.
There are so many of those guys that were in the war. Bill Decker, he was drafted, but they discovered that he knew an awful lot about transmitters. There was no sideband. It was all AM, folks. It was all AM. And he went to, sent him to the Air Force Base 4 miles from where I'm sitting, Scott Air Force Base, in just across the river from the Arch, St. Louis. He spent his time there teaching airmen how to fix radios. We're talking about the radios in the B-29, the Fifis, and the B-25s, all of those early aircraft that won the war. The war would not have been anywhere close if they didn't have the communications of AM radio in airplanes. And Bill Decker in 4VMY was one of those. I met up with Bill on 75 meters, 15, 20 years ago. Every night you'd find him on 75, holding court. We had so much fun. Then we'd start going to Hamfest together or whatever. We'd get together. That's the fun part of Hamfest is you go to see your friends and then look and see if you can buy some parts. But Bill was an amazing guy. He was so good at building, and he built a lot of AM transmitters. We're talking about transmitters as big as a refrigerator, huge. And I just this past week had a call on 75 on AM. It was Don, WB4HAK. I've known Don for a long time, and he'd been off the air for a while. I said, "Hey, you sound great. What are you doing?" He says, "I just acquired one of Bill Decker's transmitters." And he was using one of the homebrew transmitters of Bill Decker's. And my gosh, it sounded great. It just sounded so great. And I saw another one just a couple of weeks ago, and there's a few of them kicking around. He loved building so much, he would build a transmitter. And we're talking big transmitters here, and with the window in them, you look in there and see the big tubes glowing, and he would build them, and then he'd give them to people. He just wanted to hear them back on the air, but he passed away a few years ago, and it was so kind of Ted and your family to come up here. We had about, I think there were 8 or 10 guys that we all were very good friends of Bill Decker's, and we sat around a table at Heil Sound and talked about Bill Decker. They were Bill Decker stories because we all, every one of us, learned so much from Bill. And it just was one of those things when you lose these kind of people, what do you do? And I've been trying to get some of the guys back on AM, and we're seeing a resurgence of AM. And one of the reasons is that the new radios sound great on AM. They all have a button on them now that says AM. And a lot of guys say, "What the heck is that?" Well, this weekend, anybody listening to my voice that has any kind of transmitter and an amateur radio license, join us on 75 meters. It's going to happen at Saturday. Zero Zulu on Saturday, April 1st, and it's going to conclude on 2359 Sunday. That is Saturday. When Friday turns to Saturday, why, get on. It's all day Saturday.
Now, we've got, I want to mention this, but because what is really helping drive this is we've got a new sheriff in town, folks. And I think you should talk a little bit about this fella, NY2RF, Tom Gallagher, because he's been on Ham Nation, and I know you guys have talked, on the air and as well as off the air. But this gentleman has a heart for AM radio. I want you to talk about that a little bit, because I think that's a...
Here's the deal. Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, at 8 o'clock Central, we are going to have Clark, who started this whole deal with the league and all of the people up in the New England area. Clark Burkhardt he's N1BCG. He's the guy to put this together. He's coming on the show along with Tom Gallagher, the new CEO of the ARRL. And we're going to have all kinds of video and pictures, and we're going to talk about this AM thing. And we're going to show you, just turn your radio where it says AM and talk. Because what happens with most of the new radios today, when you put it on AM, they already adjusted the carrier balance and everything. You don't have to do anything. Just turn it on AM and talk. Might have to set your mic gain up a little bit here, down there, whatever. But please join us this weekend, April 1st and April 2nd, all day, night, all the way through. You're going to hear a ton of AM. It's the way it used to be. It's the way it used to be. And you're going to have shortwave listeners. You're going to have people all over the globe listening. And it's going to be so much fun. And I just love AM because you heard this story before. That's how I learned so much of this stuff, and I want to teach it to you. And in closing, I have to tell you one of the monster projects that happened here in the last month. I came up with this project that I keep trying to get people to build on Ham Nation. George, W5JDX, he's got a – I started this little thing called Smoke and Solder at the very beginning of Ham Nation 5 years ago, and George picked it up. He's so good at it. We got Randy on there, all these guys building things. But I wanted to do something that we could involve you and – so I came up with this idea of how we used to do it. And we did it on little pieces of plywood, pine board. We didn't do a chassis. Gosh, that means metalwork. So, I mean, you can. But to get started, we have a project on Ham Nation. It started about 3-4 weeks ago. It's called the Pine Board Project. W0BVT. A good friend of mine that we work every morning on that 75-meter net, 3885 at 9 o'clock Central. He gets on every day with a pine board project. I went to see him, and, gosh, he's got all kinds of transmitters and receivers built on pine board. So we started it. We've built the power supply, and we go through and explain. We're going to do more explanation tomorrow night of kind of finishing that power supply. I've already had dozens of guys send me pictures of their stuff. I'll have a few of them on there tomorrow night. But now we're going to build the mic preamplifier with the 12AX7. Oh, did I mention all of this stuff is using tubes? Oh, yeah. And then we'll get that going. I'll take a month or so, and we'll go through all of it and explain how it works, things you can do to make it better, do this, do that. Then we're going to build the transmitter. And it can be either on 40 meters, it can be on 75 meters. I got a picture, and it'll be on tomorrow night. I got a picture from a guy in Canada. He built one of the rigs ahead of. I showed the whole schematic right at the first bit here 3-4 weeks ago when I was thinking about it. He took that picture. It was just on there a short time. He took that picture and built his own rig, and he was working a couple of stations already with it. So, see, and I guess in closing, the best thing that's happened to this deal is a letter, and I got 3 or 4 of them, but a letter I got from a guy at K7, and he said, I want to thank you for doing this pine board project. I did it years ago, so I started doing it again. He said, my teenage daughter is a ham, but she never got interested and had her little handy-dandy talkie, and that was it, but she lost. So I started this pine board a couple weeks ago. She's in here. She wants to do it too, so she's building a pine board transmitter to put on 75 meters. You can pay me all the money in the world, which I get nothing for all this. Don't write anything into that. You could give me all the money in the world, and it wouldn't mean anything like that letter I got that this guy took this project that we came up with on Ham Nation. It's happening right now, and got his kids involved. I got another one today where a guy, his nephew, wants to come in and help him build another pine board AM transmitter. That's what it's about, Ted. We could be here for weeks talking about whatever happens, but it's all there because we need guidance, and we now finally have it. Finally have guidance from the ARRL. from Tom Gallagher, and he'll be on tomorrow night. You'll get to see and hear him, and we're extremely excited to have our programs transmitted on this monster transmitter on AM, and Saturday night I get to play the theater organ. I mean, well, my gosh, I got all my loves here. The only thing I need to do is put Sarah on my lap while I do all this, and I've got three of them right here.
Well, you know, I want to, one thing, though. I want you to take just a minute. You know, there's a lot of fellas. I mean, I remember running a Globe Champ 300 on AM, and I had an SX-101 Hallicrafters. That was ham bands only now, you know. Yeah. The thing drifted. I wanted one so bad, you know. But anyhow, operating AM and the guys calling sideband slop bucket. Okay, that was what they called it. It was big war between the yes. sideband guys and the AM. But I want you to talk a little bit about the AM window and what's actually happening with AM radio now. And one thing I will realize, I tuned in the other night and I heard a guy talking, and he had built a pulse duration modulation transmitter himself, but PDM modulation. Oh, it sounded beautiful on the ear. But talk about the AM window just a few. I know we're out of time, but we can stretch this just a little bit, and you can tell me a little bit about that, or talk to the folks about the AM window.
When I was in when I came on the air in 1956, it was all AM, very little sideband. And they started to happen, not me, but some of the guys, I was on 6 meters AM. But as I'd listen down and around, these guys were having wars. I know personally of one instance, and this was one of many, where a guy that was on single sideband, sitting in the middle of the AM guys, he wouldn't get off, just pestering them to death, one day got a knock at his door from a major AM operator.
Oh, boy.
And he had a shotgun in his hand. And he said, I'm here to tell you that if you don't pay more attention, there's going to be consequences. And, I mean, there were wars, personal wars. So what happened is about, oh, I think it ended up around 59, 1960, somewhere. Some of the guys got together, the AM guys and sideband guy, big-time dudes, you know, major guys. And they got together and did what they called a gentleman's agreement. And that's another interesting thing. You don't hear all the bad language. You don't hear all the fussing and fighting and ego trips and crap that happen on AM. It's all gentlemen and ladies. And they formed a gentleman's agreement back in those days. 3870, write this down if you don't know it, 3870 to 3890, stay away from there. The trick is we can only get about 4 a.m. contacts in there. The sidebanders have mega cycles above it and below it. But just give them the peace. Be a gentleman and a lady. It's 3870 to 3890 on 40 meters. We only get two frequencies, 7290 to 7295. You stay out of there with your single sideband or your CW or your slow scan television. It's all a gentleman's agreement to let this AM group have it. And 14, 268, 263, somewhere up in there on 20 meters. But just be cognizant that you don't want to go slamming on top of an AM signal. And that's what happens. And
well, you know, I was thinking more on the order, too, of folks that are not familiar with that would love to find it and listen, you know, and learn about it. And I think a lot of folks would find it fun. So that was the other reason why I wanted you to mention the AM window, was because so the folks can discover that. Now, is any of that, is there an AM window, like, for example, on 17 meters at all? Or do you know?
No, the AMers, we pretty much stay off of 17. They're gentlemen. They don't want to cause any problems. We really don't need 17 meters. We got enough frequencies, and they've been gentlemen about it. Not to say you won't find it. It's quite legal to do it, but to go pile on a bunch of sideband stations, they don't want to do it. So that's the story with that. We're going to cover a lot more of that tomorrow night on Ham Nation. I hope you get to listen and watch, and the most important thing, get involved in this Pine Board project. It's just taken over my life. It's like, whoa, but that's okay. I love it. and we're glad to do it.
And the other thing, too, is if you've got young people that are either hams or not hams, if you want to really introduce them to something very cool that they may get completely carried away with.
That's what happened to a couple of these emails I got this week. But then, you can always reach me. Just send me an email, Bob at HeilSound, HeilSound. And look up our website. We are going here in the next week or two. We're going to have a whole section on our website about the Pine Board Project and EAM stuff. So be watching that. They've got a new site coming up. We're going to be having a little corner just for us characters that like AM. And you're one of those, Ted Drendel. And I thank you for all you do to make it happen. And we'll come back again and talk about more. But
be sure to send Bob an email. If you're listening tonight, Be sure you. I know we get lots of email, but you know he really enjoys getting those emails. Matter of fact, he's got people that are really high that are listening to him sending emails. One guy in particular at 35,000, 37,000 feet in the air. That's part of my pun here.
Yes.
tell the folks about that. That's really a cool story, I think. And then we'll put the lid on this, and we'll meet up again real soon on the radio.
Well, I got this email from a guy. He's an airline pilot, and he was 1,700 miles west of L.A. at 37,000 feet on a Saturday listening to my theater organ music from WTWW. And you see, the aircraft radios are all AM. Think about this a minute. They're not sideband. They're not FM. They're AM. There's a reason for it. My gosh, we'd be here all night. AM gets better, gets through better when you get into big fades and stuff. But all of the aircraft radio from day one has been amplitude modulated. And he has an AM receiver, and he's got several of them. And he's got his regular communications that he keeps on frequency. But he's got one he can roam around with, and it's on WTWW, and here's this character playing theater organ. So he's a regular listener, and now he's listening to Ham Nation because he's a ham also. So what can I tell you? It's all fun. Thank you very, very
much. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And David, any final comments here? David's been sitting here listening to the whole thing. And
I've enjoyed the heck out of every one of these stories. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, thank you. And David, since he gave you this new position, do you have business cards?
They are currently getting printed up. I think Holly is going to be designing all of them for me, and we'll get those printed up.
Absolutely, want a really good picture of him.
I'll tell you, we've been sending out tons of QSLs, and people asking for QSLs, and boy, we just every night she's doing a stack of these things, you know. And I hope we're making everybody. Bob Heil, thank you so much for being our guest tonight, and tomorrow night, of course, folks, Ham Nation at 8 p.m. Central, and you can hear it right here on 5085 and on Twit TV. And I guess tell the folks about the Ham Nation site or how they can get the video portion. I know if they go to Twit TV, it's real easy to find.
I do. I tell it better. Just go to Google and put Ham Nation in there. When it comes up, pow, first one, hit it, and you'll be there.
There you go. Thank you so much, 73s. You have a good night, and we'll look forward to hearing you tomorrow night on Ham Nation.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ted, David, and everybody out there. Bye-bye for now.
Now, some think that the ARRL is a bunch of old guys with square glasses and powdered wigs in Newington, Connecticut, looking down their noses at the ham radio fraternity. It's just not so. The ARRL is all the thousands of people you see at the Dayton Hamvention and Flea Market, the smiling faces at Hamcation, the happy people at Pacificon, Huntsville, HamQuest, Shelbyville, Dalton, and many, many more. All the hams that listen to the QSO radio show and the thousands of hams that listen to WTWW, that's the ARRL. All the folks that are listening and watching Ham Nation. Hams in Washington, D.C., representing you
and all the hams to the FCC, protecting our rights as members of this fraternity. And right now, you can be a part of the ARRL for $49.95. That's right, you get 12 issues of QST, a major technical magazine. Very professional magazine. What? 12 issues for $49.95? But not only do you get that, you get every issue of QST ever published online. You get representation in Washington. And you know what? They offer a consulting service. Got a problem with your radio or your antenna or your installation? You can call Newington, Connecticut and get an expert on the telephone to help you talk you through your problems. 1 year membership to the ARRL for $49.95 is the best possible deal you could ever hope to find in terms of ham radio. Go to their website, ARRL.org. That's ARRL.org, and join today.